That tangle is gone. He makes a statement. The least you have done unto one of these, you have done it unto me. They who were present thought he was referring to the people in the crowd. But he was actually referring to an extrasensory experience occurring in another realm, in another area of time. It was the wise man who was coming to see him and was bringing him a gift. It was a pearl of great price. That man was a physician. He was a physician king. He had to sell the gift in order to make a compound or a medicine to save the life of an infant. It's in one of the Eastern scrolls, and it occurred in the time when Jesus was in the body. And when that man arrived in Jerusalem, he had already arrived on the day when the Master was being hung on the cross. And he just saw him at that last moment. But that will be verified by a scroll, the Dead Sea Scrolls, as they're being dug up more and more and dug in. The man did live, and they're going around with the fact that he was a figment of imagination, that somebody foisted a big story in the whole world. But he will be vindicated by humanity, and a great deal will be understood of what the purpose of his life is. Then we can understand the purpose of our own life, what he's really telling us. You see?
What is the meaning of the gifts?
Gold. Well, if you give someone gold, automatically you lift up their economical status, you know. So you can't say Jesus was a poor man. In no way, shape, or form, you can say, if his parents were having a baby in a manger, that would automatically put him in a high income bracket. But gold was symbolic in the East as royalty or kingship. Only the royalty or the kings had access to gold and kept gold freely or gave gold freely. It was a symbol of his royalty, his heritage. Not in the material sense of the word as a material king. These men were mystics. They were called the Magi, wise. They were aware from within themselves that here was a soul who was not born by the will of the flesh or by the will of man, but by the will of God, entering into humanity to lift up humanity. And they who were enthroned in their own bodies as mystics, they were also elevating their consciousness that they can see on that level his mission and would know what his mission would represent to the world. And out of respect for that manifestation, or what the Eastern people call avataro, or descent of God into the flesh, the Hebrew calls it Emmanuel, God in man, the incarnate spirit, they saw this in the inner realm, and they left their country, bringing him these gifts, symbolically representing kingship, which is gold, frankincense or incense, which is priesthood, and myrrh, which he used to embalm, mastery of life over death. They knew that he was a living master. They knew that he had come back into the world to prove his power of life over death. Well, the pearl was never delivered.
But he would have a meaning, wouldn't
he? Yes. He made many references to the pearl, you know. What did he say?
He said if you cast a pearl among the swine,
it turned around you. And pearl of great price. He was aware of the fourth wise man coming. Therefore, he referred to the gift that was coming to him. The pearl is a stone that is used for therapy in the ancient countries. The construction of its crystalline nature someday will be proven by scientists as a cure for certain systematic diseases. until we have sufficient knowledge of the structure of the pearl, and if the pearl is produced by the artificial method, which the Japanese do, so that the oyster build it, we can have a way of compounding it into this type of a tablet for a certain type of disease. Remember, disease is also interlocked with our karma.
In that case, naturally the physician would know that.
Mm-hmm.
The ancient people knew this, and we've lost it.
Yes. Any more questions? I don't want to hold up the janitor gate tonight and let him feel that we've overworking our goodness. Tonight we do have a little meditation, and if you'd like to join, glad to have you. Meditation is not prayer. Prayer is telling God what He should do for you. Meditation is God telling you what you should do for Him. So in meditation we go into a state of receptivity. In prayer we go into a state of transmission. So if you want to join us, we'd be glad to have you there. Thank you.
Sessions in a way that really reached the heart and soul of the real meaning of them. And I think we have another real treat in store for us today. I think probably everyone here today has been here before. I see a few new faces. So for those of you who do not know Adama, he comes to us from Tyler, Texas, where he is the leader of the All Faith Fellowship, a wonderful spiritual retreat in every sense of the word. His Swami name is Nityananda Saraswati, and his Christian name is Adama Christopher Lay. We've been really blessed to have him with us these last few days. And I think the thing that I think of most when I hear Adama and when I see him is love, just an all-abiding love that just seems to permeate the presence all around. And we're very privileged to have you with us again today to speak to us at Real Christmas Day. Adama.
Thank you. I said before, for those who don't know, this is not a lecture for Swamis. This is what we call a satsanga. Satsanga means fellowship with truth. At a satsanga, three things are occurring. One, an intellectual contact. Two, a literal contact or physical contact. And three, an extrasensory contact. But before we can start a satsanga, we have to calibrate our minds, because the mind is restless from driving a car, trying to get here in time, wondering what you're going to do or say or listen to. So the mind is in a state of turmoil. And therefore, to calibrate the mind, just let us enter in consciousness. Thank you. We come to the last part of the Beatitudes today, because the Beatitudes, we know, is attitudes of how to be. And when the Master Jesus was speaking, as I said, he often spoke on three levels: a physical level, an intellectual level, and an extrasensory or mystic level. And in order to really comprehend the Master, you have to understand how he blends the levels: the literal level, the intellectual level, so it portrays the essence or the mystic level. In the Beatitudes, we find that we are using the word blessed. And as I said, the word blessed does not mean happy, because in the new versions of the Bible, they're using the word happy instead of blessed. This is because they're trying to change the terminology in English. But those people who are translating in the new writings are not mystics. The King James Version, the men who were writing were mystics. They had an inner experience. And blessed had an entire different meaning than happy, because the word blessed means to consecrate, to lift up. It's next to bliss. It's a state beyond happiness. Happiness is only the next level above cheerfulness in the scale of emotions. And the highest level is bliss. So blessedness is next to bliss, and bliss is God. It's the state in which every realized mystic enters, or ecstasy. So when we use the word blessed, we are thinking in terms of a divine experience. When you use the word happy, we are not using a divine experience. We're thinking now in psychological levels of the subjective nature. Therefore, we are selling ourselves short by accepting the new translations as an ideal way to interpret what a master like Jesus would be teaching. In the first place, he came to elevate our consciousness by living out these experiences, not by instituting any new belief, but by demonstrating these beliefs. So when he used the word blessed, we have to realize we're talking and communicating on a very high level of experience. Now, we covered the first 8 Beatitudes, and we're going to cover this last few, which ties in why the Sermon on the Mount was not directed to the general public, because it was directed to his disciples more so. Though he spoke openly, the impact and the intent was intended for the spiritual life of the individual, the journey of the soul back to God. Not so much of the outward life. The outward life was a preparatory process which can be taken on a literal level or an intellectual level. But when it comes down to the intuitive level, the contemplative level, the mystic level, it means entirely different to the individual, because each individual has to make this discovery within himself. He has to experience the Christ intelligence. So we go to the next beatitude, it says, blessed are they who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Now, if we say a man is persecuted for righteousness' sake, and he will inherit the kingdom of heaven, we can see that in terms of an individual trying to represent some group of people on this earth, trying to fight for the underdog. That's in a literal sense of the word. Righteousness would mean right thinking, adhering to the laws of the society. And if we persecute this individual or try to tear him down in spite of all he stands for, we can eventually say, well, he will inherit heaven because he did his best. From our literal view of the thing, we will say that is all that Jesus meant when he was on the earth. So we can all adhere or emulate that person by stepping out, fighting for the underdog, and hoping the world will say, cheer, cheer, that boy, here he goes on to heaven now. But that is not the true intent. It is a stepping stone in behavior. It is a stepping stone to correct the environmental situations that are around us. We should stand up for the underdog or someone who's downtrodden. We should try to adhere to the right rules of thinking as a group activity, as a collective activity. But when it comes down, when a person is by himself, when he has to face his inner thoughts, the inner experience of trying to align his consciousness with the divine, that is the big question. Is he really following the true principles of consciousness? Though he may be championing the underdog, is he championing the cause of the divine nature within himself? Does he know the real purpose for existing? Does he know the real reason for his own personal existence? Now, when we look at it from the mystic standpoint, blessed are they who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for there is the kingdom of heaven, is when the individual decides to pursue a definite path of realization by aligning his consciousness with God, by taking time out from his daily activities to spend that time in seclusion, solitude, the right approach to inner peace, and subjects himself to the ridicule of others, the harassment of others for being a nincompoop of sitting in a corner with his eyes closed and trying to do like that, what you call meditating or getting lost in himself. Most of us will say, there goes that idiot there sitting on a stone thinking he's something superior. And what is he trying to prove? But that individual has separated his consciousness temporarily from the environment to pursue the inner approach, the inner peace. He wants to re-evaluate the purpose of existence, the purpose of his own personal existence. Where does he fit into the picture as a being? Where is his greatest contribution as a being? Not only to society, but to himself and his creator. How is he a channel for his creative intelligence? Unless he sits down and takes time out and secludes himself from the harassment, he will not be able to elevate himself. He will not be able to get into that consecrated state, let alone have an experience of divine awareness. Well, as soon as he decides to do that, his closest enemy is the one who lives right next to him. Jesus said, your enemies are very close to you. They may be your very loved ones, because they may not want you to be spiritual, lest you get a head start to heaven before them. So what they'll do, they'll try to harass you, and they'll try to pick at you, and before you know it, you may get discouraged. Well, as long as they get you discouraged, and they feel they've won the first round, then you feel guilty for having given in. Then you're torn up now between going their way or trying to really go inward. But you know, it's difficult to go inward where only you and your thoughts and your body and an unseen God is going to be in communion. And it's much easier to be outside with them, joining them, where you can see the world, you can vouch that this is a desk, this is a rose, that's a light, and everything around here are pretty well stable. You don't have to fear too much. So the mind is tossed between the outer world being genuine and the inner world being a figment of imagination or assumption. Well, we said, blessed are they who are persecuted for righteousness' sake. Now, righteousness would be the right laws of being, the right principles of inner awareness. So, if you don't harm no one, if you seek solitude, calmness, you seek to pray, you seek to contemplate, you seek to be creative in your consciousness, you don't indulge yourself with the sensory world too much, that tends to aggravate others. And they are forced to harass you for it. Well, if you don't let them harass you, and you stick to your resolutions, you will surely inherit the kingdom of heaven. You will have the experience of an inner certitude, of an extrasensory awareness or an extrasensory experience of what divine consciousness is. Not a sensory consciousness, not an intellectual consciousness, but an extrasensory experience. It will occur within you, an actual experience of a different nature than the normal run-of-the-mill experiences that happen every day to you. Something that will stand apart, distinct, that would give you the strength to say, I've had an inner experience, I am sure that this inner experience represents something spiritual to me. You have one problem when you have the experience. You can't tell nobody. After spending all that time to get it, you can't go tell nobody because they're not going to believe it. And if you tell anybody, you're crazy. So you find yourself in a worse position now. Having spent all that time to aggravate others to the point of being harassed by them for your spiritual unfoldment, you can't even expose it to no one. So you say, God has done your dirty trick. Why did he make it so impossible to communicate such a wonderful experience and leave you here now, hanging in sort of a limbo? No way to say anything to anyone, what is true or what is not true. But Jesus goes on to assure you. That's where the Master comes in now. The assurance that what you have done has merit. It has nothing to do with the outer world. It has something to do with you and your devotion to God. He says now, rejoice. This is his encouragement for your attempt. Rejoice and be exceedingly glad. He's already pointing out what you should do after having the experience and after having shut out yourself from everyone and accomplishing it. Great is your reward. Now he's giving you the encouragement and inspiration for having made the attempt. Because He had to have achieved it before he could tell it to you. It stands to reason. If he'd never walked the inner life, the inner experience, then telling it to us would not mean anything to us. He would have to have walked it, then he would be the one to confirm it, that what we're experiencing is valid. So, taking his promise, we have something of value we can live with in spite of others harassing us and tearing us down. Great is your reward in heaven. Great is this reward in total awareness. Rejoice and be glad, exceedingly glad. Be totally immersed in it. Don't worry now what human minds say about you, having spent the time to get the experience. It is worth everything to have it. For the persecuted, they, the prophets, which were before you. In other words, you are in good company. Your experience is nothing new, nothing looked down upon by the Creator as something bad. The world before you came along treated the other great realized souls the same way. But if you can stand and measure up in the Hall of Fame of prophets, I don't think you have to worry. You see, this is the amazing part of the unfoldment. When you know from inside that the inner experience is valid, the type of people who have achieved it are the ones that are looked up throughout the history of man as the highest examples of behavior, then all the persecution and the harassment doesn't begin to compare for the time spent in achieving it. It is well worth it, even if we have to leave the frame right now and not carry with us a single penny to the grave. As my friend said to last night, a man had $50 million, couldn't even carry a penny last night with him. So what will he carry when he's going to face the Christ inside? Can he carry any moment of inward seclusion, any moment of inner happiness? Has he any way to refer to the moments he spent to line up himself with one of the exalted beings that walked this earth that was harassed by men? I don't think he has it. But if he has that, then the 50 million wouldn't mean anything. He's got a greater reward than 50 million. So the individual who lives out the challenge, lives out the persecution and the harassment of those around him for trying to be spiritual inside, they are walking in the highest company possible. Now, in the Eastern scriptures they say, you know them by the company they keep. So, if you're walking in the company of prophets that have gone on ahead, you can be classified as a prophet too, because that is the company you're keeping. They say a spiritual man gains spirituality four ways in Eastern countries. One, attending satsanga. That means fellowship with the truth. Two, sitting in the company of saints or prophets. Three, adhering to the will of the Lord. And four, inner solitude. Now, if you look at those four ways, you'll see that the last one indicates how we should behave. It's the beatitude that starts the process for the other three. So Master Jesus is confirming for the individual who gives up the time to inner solitude. Now in this Western world, and especially in the Eastern world, we have a problem with the adults and the senior citizen. We're reaching a stage where we're going to be retired at early age, and our children and grandchildren are gone. And sometimes the loved one or the partner is gone on. Time hangs heavy on us. We don't know what to do with ourselves. The period of loneliness can be like a mallet hanging over your head, or like an axe hanging over your head. You think you are not worthy or worth anything in this world. But this is your greatest moment to find the inner life, because you're given the opportunity now to study within yourself. You're given the opportunity to research into yourself. All the time was spent researching and working for others, your children, your grandchildren, your loved one. It was outward behavior, outward exposure, but very little inner exposure. Now you have the time for inner exposure. So, since you don't have the one to harass you now, you're better off. Before they might have harassed you if you tried it. Here you are, totally free yourself now. For the balance of your life, you can go inward and really make full use of the time spent. And you'll be exceedingly joyful in the discovery. Now Jesus went on to say, in confirming the attitude, ye are the salt of the earth. This is not a way of saying blessed. Ye are the salt of the earth. Well, salt sounds kind of funny. Why would he call it the salt of the earth? What do we use salt for? What is salt composed of? We know salt is composed of sodium chloride. And you are the salt of the earth. If we put salt in the food, that's where we use it most of the time. We find it gives it a savor or a flavor. If we look at the human body, the bloodstream is like salt water. The chemical composition is nearly the same. In the mystic view of it, ye are the salt of the earth. It means that you are that particular individual whose inner life adds the flavor to society lacking in spirituality. You are that particular individual who radiates the perfect state of inner composure. It raises and enhances society that may be caught up in a literal existence and in an intellectual existence. But who was he referring to when he said, ye are the salt of the earth? Was he referring to the world? Or was he referring to his disciples, who were supposed to be trying to develop themselves from going inside and exposing themselves to the inner life and gradually withdrawing from the pull and the desire of the outer world? He was actually referring to his own students, his own disciples, if they took the path of inner realization, that they would be like the salt of the world. They would be like a savoring, a force field. There would be a power in this existence in which we are right now that would enhance, tend to raise up others. But he says, if the salt has lost its savor, meaning its flavor, if the individual who is supposed to pursue this spiritual life suddenly finds himself or herself no longer fragrant, no longer emanating this particular quality of inner light because of despondency, distraction, harassment, and slowly lacking in devotion, where will it go to get its savor? Where will the salt go to be salted? If the salt has lost its saltedness or its savory taste, where will it go to get it? When the spiritual man has made the attempt to go inside, that applies to every human being now, and suddenly finds himself lacking the devotion to persevere to the end, to have the mystic experience, and suddenly finds himself drifting back into the sensory nature of the world, where would he go? To who would he go to give him the encouragement to go back inside? We automatically find ourselves abandoned. The outer world couldn't give it to us when we started, and certainly now, after a long attempt to go inwards, we become despondent and lack the devotion and drift back. We'll be worse off than when we started off. It is better we never did started in the first place. Do you get the idea? So, don't be despondent if you find the journey inward seems to be harassing and not as productive right away. Be of good cheer. Because you're walking in the company of prophets. You're walking in the pathway of those who actually walk that path, achieving patience, strength, sense of certitude, hope. And that is a slow process for the individual. So when we go inward, we must be prepared to make the resolution to ourselves that nothing else matters now. Time matters not. How long we take to achieve this inner experience. We know what the outer world has to offer us. We know what we will encounter if we fall back. We don't know what we will encounter if we go forward. At one time I was climbing up a mountain, you know, I was trying to do mountain climbing. And my friend is ahead of me. And I'm halfway up the side and I start to get cold feet. I want to go back down to the ground. I start looking down how far I am for how far I'm up. And something says, if you go down, there's no guarantee you'll ever get up back, because you may slip and land on your back. And if you go up, there's no guarantee you'll ever get across the mountain on the other side. So you're stuck. Make up your mind where you want to go. Well, I looked at my friend up there and he says to me, stop looking down. You're only going to go back and you go back in fear. Look up and give me your hand. And why worry? You only can fall down once. And when he said that, I said, okay, here I come. I don't know what's up there, but I'm coming just the same. It is the same way with the inner life. We try to start out inwardly, and we look back at a certain point of the growth. It's very disappointing and frustrating. And so, gee whiz, I come all this way, I'm really getting nothing. And I try to look back. I want to go back. But if I go back, I know pretty well I'm not going to get back as far as I go. So, the inward life is the consecrated devotion, and time does not matter. It's like a chicken in an egg. If you take an egg and put it under a hen, it takes 21 days for the egg to hatch. The setting hen has to generate a certain bodily heat to be willing to sit on the egg. And when that period of heat seems to wane, she knows exactly when to get off that egg. But you know something? She'll never break that egg. Even though she knows it's 21 days and that egg has to snap. But during that whole period while she's sitting on the egg, she's making some peculiar noises around it, as if to tell the chicken inside, hey, come on, get out. And when 21 days come, the egg snaps. You never know which side it's going to snap either. But when it snaps, you see the chicken pushing its head out. And you think that the mother hen would have compassion on the chicken and take off the shell. No. I was a kid, I saw that, and I said, come on, take the egg shell off. Won't take it off. So I tried to help the chicken by taking the egg off, and the chicken started to die. So I realized at that age, we don't help anyone by trying to be in a hurry. And the other chickens that were being hatched, they struggled and struggled, and it was aching me to look at them. But nevertheless, those chickens came out healthy. Equally true, in the spiritual path, we go inside, we dedicate ourselves to this life of inner solitude, inner composure. And we don't know when this creative love that surrounds us is going to allow us to snap the band, this invisible light band, this darkness around the consciousness, so that we will see the light that Jesus talks. He says the light is shining in the darkness, and darkness comprehends it not. You don't know when. It comes like a thief in the night. But if you persevere, boom, it snaps. And when it snaps, you know, there's nobody out there to tell you, here, I'm waiting for you all this time, I'm going to take away all the layers of your ignorance. You've got to wake up and shake it off and recognize where you are. But you are happy that someone is sitting there as an example of what you will be if you mature. The chicken is happy to see the mother hen sitting there, knowing someday it will be bigger than mother hen. But the mother hen is not doing anything, but it's just saying, well, pick, 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 pick. So sooner or later, when you break through this mental ignorance, you start picking up the loose ends of the inner life and the outer life, and you start tying in. That is what the Master really meant when he said, where would you go to find the savor after this loss? You have to go back inside. The next important aspect he said that if it has lost its savor, meaning its power to do something that it was intended to do, it was good for nothing. And therefore be taken and be trodden into the earth. That situation applies to the inner life. When we turn back after making the endeavor to go inward, and then suddenly find we're lacking the devotion. We have actually set our mind on the ideal to succeed, but we did not set our mind on the ideal to be one with God. We're looking inward for something magical or something miraculous. We want to come out with some kind of a power because we sat down and meditated and tried to get an experience. And now that we fail, we feel shamefaced to face our friends who may say, look, you spent all your life, what did you get? And you will be downtrodden in this sense because your own mind will start deteriorating you. You'll feel the guilt complex. You can't hold your face up in front of others. You felt you're a failure. And most people who have fallen away from the spiritual path, you see it. They have a tendency to be very despondent, downtrodden, and they almost want to kill themselves. But if we did not set the motive for a miraculous experience, for some kind of a power to impress our fellow men because we went on a particular way of life to find the inner composure, we would not be despondent. The right attitude is to be one with God. Now, one with God has no time limit. It has an unfolding period, moment to moment. And the moment to moment exposure is joy, bliss. Every inch of the way inward is success. From the time the egg is put under the chicken or the hen to the time it's completed as a chicken, every moment was success. Equally true inside of us. From the time we shut out our five senses from the environment to the daily immersion with the Spirit, every moment of that onward is success. Therefore, we don't look back no more. We always look forward. Now, Master Jesus goes on to emphasize the gifts of this attitude of life, the beatitude. He says now, ye are the light of the world. You are like a city on a hill that is not hidden. These statements are the promises of the attitudes of behavior. He said of himself, I am the light of the world while I am in the world. He says to his disciples or people who follow the path, you are the light of the world, but you are like a city on a hill that is not hidden. That means the moment you discover the inner path, and you begin to be lit up. As the kid says, now I'm lighting up, I'm illuminated, I'm starting to know myself. You're like a sore thumb stuck out from the rest. Like a city on a hill, you can't miss it. You're coming up the city, you know, the highway, and up the hill you see the city highlights, it's there, bright and brilliant. It's not hidden behind trees or anything. The spiritual person who makes the attempt to go in, though it's a blessed, consecrated state to strive for, it carries certain complications of exposure. And the exposure is that you're going to be singled out by society as an unusual individual, as either you're a quack, or you've got something loose in your head, or maybe you aren't so stupid as you appear. So they single you out for one of the three. But nothing to worry about. You are a light. That means you're shining. There's something about you that sets you apart from the rest. There's something about you that attracts people to you. It's something that's in you that seems to grow and expand. And therefore we can't hide you nowhere. We would wish to get rid of you, but we don't know how to do it. We'd wish you'd get lost in some place so nobody would really know that you did exist. Nobody wants to read the pages of history and know men like Moses, Elijah, Jesus, Buddha, or Krishna ever did walk this earth. It's too much of a shock to our intellect that here among teeming millions of men, these few handful of people are standing out like cities. He is telling us in the Sermon of the Mount, and it's intended most for the disciple, the mystic student, not so much for the ordinary layman, because the ordinary layman can change and start the mystic life, because it's from the ordinary layman individuals will start to search for the mystic life. But those who are already on the path of the mystic life, these are the ones he calls his disciples or students. Those are the ones who are walking in his steps. And the sermon or the lessons are intended for them. The inner workings are intended for them, because they can't be left to themselves. He's on the earth. He has lived these lessons himself. He's trying to raise our consciousness to those heights. And by accepting certain people as his students, he would have to see them all the way through in the inner experiences. You'd have to give them the assurances that they are not making a fool of themselves. And we see that even then, while he was with them and still elevating them, they were doubtful as to their worthiness as students, because they were afraid of, and they sensed it when he was going to die. And they asked him, Master, what become of us when you go? But then he reads their thoughts, and not the multitude, it was the thoughts of his students. He said, in my Father's house there are many mansions. I go to prepare a place for thee, you the students. If it were not so, I would tell you. In other words, he was more concerned with those who were seeking the inner life, a pathway to God that is not charted out in no book. There is no human written record of how you go from step to step to God inside, and you can't say that A turns B corner, C, and so forth. We have to have the word of a living teacher or some individual who's walked that path to give us the encouragement to stick with it. And as long as he gives us the assurance that it's not a journey of futility, it's not a journey of mental games, it's not a journey of strictly biding time, because there's nothing else to do in this world. We're too caught up in our desires, or because everyone has left us and now we are left to ourselves, nothing else to do but wait to die. It is not that. It is a journey that is actually lived by the great ones and achieved by these great ones. And if they were not positive of what the end of the journey would mean or involve, They could not vouch for it. And they can't make up the journey. The journey would have to be the same for everybody. They can't come and say, we have a new religion and this is the new way to get there. They can't come and say, well, when you get there, he looks a little different than he did yesterday. It is always the same, and it's the one same truth. And we are living it for you, and so don't be despondent. Come inside with us. Let us walk the path inside. So the Sermon on the Mount can be viewed now in another mystical sense. This is the Mount, the point between the eyebrows. The teacher, or the Master Jesus, is the intuition locked up in the brain. The multitudes, or the disciples, are the five senses of the human body. The inquisitive Sadducees, politicians, writers and scribes, Sadducees, are the ego, intellect, reason. The individual who accepts the teacher's words is the willpower. Now, Mr. Aldous Huxley wrote a book called The Island, a Lost Island, or Lost Paradise, or something like that. I think it's Lost Island, where he writes in symbology using the student as Will. That's the name he gave the student. And he went through the whole dissertation of his inner body and all the mysteries of it, writing it in fiction. He was trying to portray the Sermon on the Mount and Book of Revelation in a novel. But he used the student as Will. The disciple is Will. Disciple represents willingness to be disciplined, willingness to try. Each one of us is willing to try the inner life. But each one of us needs assurance. Each one of us needs comfort and guidance. Intuition, or that higher self, or that archetypal pattern of the spirit, is the guardian, is the angel, or is the divine comforter, is the Messiah that pulls the will, encourages the will to continue. The harassers are your five senses, the multitudes, who are constantly distracting you and presenting you with new desires, new stimulations, to go away from the journey on the Mount towards realization and come down into the lower nature and expend your energy. Now, if you are the salt, and that's the will again, that is the driving force in the body, and if it loses its savor, meaning it loses its quality to be determined, to persevere, where is the willpower going to go to get more willpower? You see, it can't turn to the five senses and say, give me some power now. It can't turn to reason and say, give me more power. It can't turn to ego and say, give me more power. It can only look up to the intuition to elevate it. So the willpower is the one force in our mechanism that we should not surrender or try to put under a state of helplessness. We find this happening in young people today. When they take the drugs to have an experience which they think is an experiencing God, three things happen to them. One, they have a loss of will. The drug that they take has to run its course, sometimes 4 or 5 hours, 8 hours, 10 hours, sometimes a whole day. And the third thing, the confusion between what is real and what is not real. The incertitude of the mind, not being certain of what is the destination. But the will can't help you there when it's no longer functioning. Once the will is helpless, you can't make a decision inside. You can't follow it up. That's the problem with the drug. Now, we can look at it another way. If you have a car coming down a hill, and you take out all the brakes, cut all the wires that will stop the car, there is absolutely nothing you can do to stop the car running down the hill. It will have to run its course until it either smashes them or it runs out of gas. The will is like the brakes. It can constantly check it until it slows down and bring it under control. Equally true, when we're meditating inwardly, if we were to pull out all the safety factors by a chemical experience and have no will to check these experiences as they come crashing in on us, and we can't sort them out and know what they really mean, we're at the mercy of our own brain and all the problems that we've incurred in. So where would we go to correct it? And who is going to correct it? And what are they going to tell us when they correct it? Can they tell us anything more, better, or worse? They can only tell us what they think they know and try to prevent us from repeating the situation. I don't advocate the fact that drugs could give you spirituality. I haven't found it to be. I don't know of any that I've met. And the Bible even admonishes it for us for that. It states, he who does not come in by the door, this is the door of consciousness, the point between the eyebrows, where we contemplate on the spirit, and enter by any other method, and they're very explicit, enter by any other method, is a thief. That means you're violating your higher self or lower self, and you're impressing some type of consciousness upon this mechanism. Finally, in the Beatitudes, we find that Jesus is telling us something that is very important, not to the layman, not to the intellectual person, but again to the students. Every one of these attitudes that we perform will give us something. It's an outright promise. You don't get something for nothing. You are not working in vain. You're not performing these actions with the fact that you will be left empty-handed. What is being offered for each level of the behavior, for each level of unfoldment, is God awareness. In many ways, he presents God awareness. One way he says, you shall inherit the kingdom of heaven. You shall be called the sons of God. You shall see God. You see, many ways to tell you how this consciousness will reward you. Seeing God, inheriting heaven, calling you the Son of God. These are all levels of inner complete awareness. Now, on the outer level, if I say that I'm a peacemaker, and after completing and negotiating between two warring parties, can I truly walk away from that table after it's all over and feel that I'm a son of God? In a literal sense, you may look up and say, this man was very godly to have brought these two people together. He's a son of God because God made his creation, and God is in his creation, therefore he's a son of God. But how is the man inside? Has he found godness inside? Not because his occupation puts him in a position to bring two people together to stop fighting. Has he got an inner experience of godness inside? We have to look at it in that direction. So we see that this Sermon on the Mount primarily is directed to the spiritual life, secondarily to the outward life. In the inward life, it hinges upon a direct communion with the Spirit. Thank you. Yes.
You in prayer a while ago then that heaven in your context is the progress you make through meditation. The objective of meditation would be health, as is in the Bible, right?
Yes, we must not look at it as a place in the heavens.
Condition, no.
It's a state of being. You see, there are eight levels of creation. The first level of creation is matter acting on matter, which we are involved in. This is hell. Now, we know it as H-E-L-L from our Bible. That is what you call the scriptural term of it. From the true scientific term of it, in the science of the soul, it's H-E-L-D. We are in a state of hell. We can't go any further than where the Creator will hold His creation. He holds us in a state of hell. That means the final expression of Himself is matter. We don't go beyond that. Now, we have to go backwards to Him. We are away from Him when we are in hell. H-E-L-D, not, but it considered H-E-L-L a place, in a literal sense of the word. In the true scientific sense of the word, or spiritual word, it's H-E-L-D. Now, the next level back to the Creator, from where we are right now, or the sensory nature, would be energy acting on matter. So we are going backwards, but we are going backwards to the Creator by our senses and by our extra senses. We go both ways, outward and inward. In the Eastern countries, they have a saying that goes like this: the further you retreat inward, the more you advance outward. You get the idea? The more you can retreat inward in your consciousness, the more you would have had control over the outer world. That's the purpose of it. So, the next level up would be now consciousness acting on matter. See, that's the third level up in creation. The fourth level up in creation is energy acting on energy. Now, these levels have oriental names in the oriental scriptures. They have Hebrew names in the Hebrew text. But we know them now in English, and therefore we don't have to use the oriental terms or the Hebrew terms, because science will one day vouch for these levels as we advance in paraphysical research. The next level up now is consciousness acting on energy. But energy acting on energy is before consciousness acting on energy. Energy acting on energy is the halfway mark referred to by Jesus when He gave the parable of the prodigal son, who was away from the father, left the father, came down, squandered his sustenance, found himself living among the pigs in a state of hell, matter. He decided this was not the proper place to stay, because even the servants of his father were faring better. He would turn around and go back. Leaving that level, he moved back until he was at the halfway mark in his inner growth. They said that Master Jesus made a remark that the father, seeing the person coming, recognized him as his son and ran to meet him halfway. Meaning that God don't meet you all the way down. He only meets you halfway. You got to make the other half up. You got to do something to prove to Him that you love Him. See? So an inward turnaround on our part towards heaven or cosmic awareness is a prerequisite. And we are met at the halfway mark. But between the starting point to the halfway mark, there is a great deal of others who come along to encourage us or coax us along. The servants or the prophets. the teachers, the saints, these are the encouragers to get us to the halfway mark. Now, the halfway mark is called energy acting on energy. Now, the next level up is in the called consciousness acting on energy. Here is the final test. What you say now, you're stripping off all the old garments and you're going to have to be cleaned up, take a bath and let the Lord put on something in you. That's the final test. Here is where we leave off now. Time. This is the last confrontation with time. Consciousness acting on energy. Because when we get beyond that state, we are entering into the Christ state or the sonship state, the recognition state, the master state. There, we are in a timeless state, consciousness now acting on consciousness. In that state, you are timeless. You are free from all desires. You are accepted back by the Father as His true Son. He places the mantle back on you. You are restored. You are lifted up. Then, from that state on, we go now to beingness acting on consciousness. This is the state that Jesus mentioned when He said to Mary, "Touch me not, I have not yet ascended to the Father." He did not leave the consciousness level of consciousness acting on consciousness or the Christ level to enter into the supreme being level, which is to sit on the right hand of the Father, to take His place in consciousness and beingness. So that seventh level is called beingness acting on consciousness. Now, we don't go any further than that, because we can't become the creator. We can't own the universe. We sit on the right hand of the Father as beingness acting on consciousness, within you that state of humility, knowing the Father still owns this world, the Father still involves Himself, and He Himself is called beingness acting on beingness. That's the eighth level.
But heaven could be the seventh level.
Heaven is your seventh level. You don't go any further than that. That's why He said, "Touch me not, I've not yet ascended unto the Father." Now, in that state, you are in total oneness with the Father, but you cannot become the Father. You can't own the universe, because all the writings show that you are a child of the Creator and you are an inheritor of His power. You have dominion of the universe to subdue it, but you don't own it. He alone is the sole owner. Up to that level, we are in heaven. Yes.
I've heard that in the Aramaic, when Jesus was talking to Peter and He would ask him, "Peter, lovest thou me?" three times, that the love were really three different levels of love. Is this true, or would you explain it?
Well, this was spoken to Peter after he returned from the grave. Not before he died. "Peter, dost thou love me?" "Yes, Master." "Then feed my sheep." He walks on a little while. "Peter, dost thou love me?" "Yes, Master." "Feed my sheep." He walks a little way. "Peter, dost thou love me?" "Yes, Master, good gosh, what you think I'm doing all this time?" "Feed my lambs." Now, twice He called them sheep. Who is He calling sheep? And who is He calling lambs? If it was levels of being, or levels in heaven, would be a different thing. He is not referring to that. What He was referring to, the love of Peter, is that Peter was a legitimate heir to the spiritual heritage when the Master left the body, for him to carry on the work. And who are His sheep and who are His lambs? The sheep are those who have already accepted the Christ and are initiated to the point where they can see the inner light, but they are not totally competent to stay in that light permanently. Now the shepherd is sheep, is Peter. The shepherd must always keep his eye on his sheep, though the sheep can graze all around, but he does not take his eye off the sheep. He still has the crook or the staff that will pull it out of problems at times. So he's informing Peter, who is going to be the spiritual head of the disciples left to carry on the work or the world, that if he always keep his mind on the Christ intelligence, which is love me, do you love me? That means if you always stay in tune with me, you will take care of those who are liable to slip back and are not too well anchored in that Christ state. Now, twice he said that. That means there are those who are at a certain level where they may about to be totally immersed in the Christ state. There are those who are just coming into the Christ state. Now, the last one is called the lambs. Now, have you seen the painting of Jesus as a shepherd with his sheep around? Where was the lamb? In his hands, right? The thing that is weakest, you keep closest to you. Now, the individual who has just been exposed to a spiritual light inside and is not too certain that this is the journey he wants to take, he may want to back out and go out again. So Peter is cautioned now, don't let that happen. Don't let these people fall back. It is up to you now as a spiritual head to make sure that they have the consolation, the correct information of staying on the path. This is true with every individual who walks the mystic path. The new student is suddenly made aware of the inner experience, but then he's not positive that that's what's going to happen. He may not see too much, and he worries. As long as he has someone to constantly console him, encourage him to stick with it, and as long as that someone stays with devotion to the light, which is the Christ in himself, you will get the courage, you will get the strength from that individual, and then you will start maturing from sheep, from lamb to sheep. Now, as we advance to the point where we are sheep now, and we are capable of fending for ourselves in a spiritual light, working inside with the divine consciousness, someday we may graduate to become a sheepdog.
I'm a lassie.
All right.
God, when the Bible talks about the great mysteries, are they referring to some of the things you've been telling us, for instance, about the different levels of consciousness, or is it something else?
No, the great mysteries are the levels of consciousness. They're just using the symbolic language.
Does it refer to more than that, or just the levels of consciousness?
No, the levels of consciousness. They're referring to that.
In the stations of the cross?
The stations of the cross is not that, because the stations of the cross are referring to the different periods in the Passion. You see, it's crucifixion. That's the stations of the cross. What he went through in the scourging and the punishment of himself before crucifixion. That's the stations of the cross. But the mysteries are not that.
We are soul.
Yes.
Can you differentiate spirit and soul?
Spirit and soul. All right. I'll give you an example. I have 10 glasses here before me. There are different sizes, different colors, different weights, different thicknesses, with different quantities of water. Above them all is the moon shining in those 10 glasses. How many moons do I have? When it shines on those 10 glasses, if I have 10 reflections. Each one of those glasses would have a reflection of the moon, right? And if you look in them, wouldn't it be correct to say that you have 10 moons? What would be correct to say? 10 reflections of the moon. Now, if I break the glass and let the water all run out and become one, how many reflections would I have in the one water? One reflection. And if I mop up all the water and there is no reflection, what would I have? Now, the spirit is the moon. The body is the glass. The mind is the water. The reflection is the soul. You got it? Your mind, that's why they say your mind should be as clear as water, and your body should be as pure and shining as the glass, and your soul should be always one with the spirit. A radiant soul. But that is the actual relationship of how we are lined up in God. He has become His creation. That is, the moon or the light, the divine principle, has come down in reflection. Come, let us make man in our what? Own image or reflection. Male and female created him. God breathed into man the breath of life, and man became a living donkey. A living soul, right? So we don't have soul, we are soul. And from the situation of the glass, the water, and the moon, we see that we don't have reflections. They are only conditions in that frame of reference. When you break away the conditions, the only thing that really exists is the moon. There would be no us without God, and there would be no us without creation for us to exist in. That is like the moon, the water, and the glass. We are the in-between thing called a reflection. You see the impermanency of ourselves? It's a kind of a short change. And here we go around spotting our ego. May I help you some more?
Are you familiar with the explanation given by Bob Ford and using the memory of places that are not the world? Did you make that explanation of the world?
What
between the soul and the spirit?
What did he give?
Well, neither was exactly, I don't recall all the details. The soul is a physical thing, according to him, which you die from again. You become the soul thing. You go to school further, another kind of school. This is shed also. You know, to shed the material body, there's more later on to shed the finer etheric substance, the soul.
Man is soul, but he is encased in three bodies. Remember, the reflection is in God, the moon. Now, that reflection can only become polluted, or appear to be polluted, or need to be purified if the water and the glass are dirty. The reflection in itself is never dirty. The real you can be dirty, but you will have all these so-called impurities in the water, and you may have discolorations by the amount of light permitting to flash through. Since man is soul, then he doesn't have a soul. Right? only obvious. Then what is he trying to say?
Well,
look carefully. He has three bodies, a chemical body comprising of 16 basic elements plus trace elements. That's the glass. He has an electrical body, or etheric body, or an astral body comprising of 19 elements. That's like the water. Now, he has also a causal body, or an archetypal body, the very pattern that makes him appear as a human being. That is comprised of 35 elements. Now, when the chemical body is smashed, that means it breaks down and, or dies, the electrical body and the idea body, or causal body, they don't break down. Now, they would go into what you would say now, the glass is broken, the water is on the floor, but the reflection isn't gone away from the water on the floor. Alright? The idea of the reflection is still in the water, but now what has happened to all the reflections? There were 10 glasses, all the glasses are broken, all the water came together. Should we not have 10 reflections still in the pool of water? But we don't have 10 reflections, we have what? One reflection. So we don't have a soul to save. We are soul already. Something has suddenly pulled us together. Now, the electrical body is the water. Now let us eradicate the water. The apparent condition that the idea now of us being something suddenly disappears into infinity, back into itself. So we can't say, I swept up the reflection off the floor. And I can't look at the mop and say, where's the reflection? It should be in the mop. Because all I did was to take up the water in the mop. I broke the glass, but the reflection has done played tricks on us. So this, the reflection goes back into its source. So the reflection is the idea. The very thing that must come forth again and again. So God is the eternal spirit projecting himself like waves of reflection as soul in creation. We come back learning to appear as images in a glass of different types and of water of different pollution. That is the various lessons we learn again. But the soul, which is the actual idea again, is never really polluted or never really restricted. Only the shape of the glass and the liquid in it will determine how large a reflection it will have. But in actuality, the reflection is neither big nor small. By smashing the containers, we go back again to the source. So, I think what Mr. Ford is saying, he's saying exactly the same thing, but I put it in different terminology. You see, we don't have a soul to save. We are soulless. What we have to save is our particular attitudes of mind. We have to correct those.
The difference may be that he uses the astral body and the soul.
Yeah. See, the Creator encased the soul, which is his reflection as an idea, in an electrical body and a chemical body, and the composite of the two is called the soul body. See? Now, and or the image body. So I said the image body is comprised of 35 elements. The electrical body is comprised of 19, and the chemical body is comprised of 16. So 16 plus 19 equals 35. So the idea body is a 35 element process, only as an image, acting as an image. Until the image recedes back into its source, then there is no need for the image. But the image must come out from the source again, back into the chemical and the electrical. Otherwise it has no identity. So the Creator must project us out all the time, out of his infinite spirit, as souls. And we tag to that soul nature. And how do we tag it? We tag it as the I Am, which is the first expression of the spirit as soul. Because when that image comes out, that reflection comes out from the moon, that reflection would be personal. It will be stating an individuality apart from the actual moon. So the very first expression of beingness in a mechanism like this would be I Am. But then you can't say I Am body. You can't say I Am the astral body. You have to say I Am soul, a reflection of the spirit. Now, when this chemical body collapses and this electrical body collapses, I Am soul actually is not really soul no more, but I Am spirit. Then Moses was right when he heard God saying to him, and he asked him, what is your name? And God said, I Am that I Am. I, the spirit, am in this, in the reflection with your soul. The two I Ams are the same. Reflection and source are the same. The beam of light and the image of the light. You see, I Am that I Am. This image is the same in the source where it's coming from. So soul and spirit merges back. And every time it's projected back out, it's projected back to the containers in which it has to work. And the lessons are in the containers. So we need bodies to learn lessons. But the lessons don't pollute the real us. You see, there is no pollution of the real us. It is kind of frustrating to think that our real us is going to be polluted. That's why they say the soul cannot do any wrong. The soul is never making any mistake. It is the pure light of God. But the body and the mind can make all the mistakes.
Talking about Saul and the backslider, the expression, you mentioned the personality of will. Can you give any more suggestions that relate to that? I may not recall, for example, for the disciples, while they got this lesson there, you know, how to try to reinforce this thing of the journey inward for themselves. Was through the visitation of the Holy Spirit,
yes,
that they really came into their power. Mm-hmm. I feel a need right there.
Good, that's very good. I remember spirit is force, and I is consciousness. I go on to the Father. But I will send you the Holy Comforter or Spirit. Now the word comforter is to comfort or to console, to encourage. And the Spirit is the force that comes down. That's why anyone who has had an experience in the Holy Spirit or Holy Comforter feel like an upsurge or an insurge of energy suddenly lifting them up and sometimes knocking them down, and they start talking in tongues. It's a force field. All right. He, the Master, that is the soul that is fully identified in the Christ, is at the level of consciousness acting on consciousness. That's the real I. That's the true I. That's the Christ I. It's going to the Father. That's it's going from consciousness acting on consciousness to being, which is the Father, acting on consciousness. But he will have to send the Holy Spirit. That's the next level below consciousness acting on energy. You see? Because that consciousness has to come down now and act in an energy field to raise our consciousness and energy up. So the Christ level is before the God level or the heaven level, and the Holy Spirit level is below. Now the salt, if it has lost its savor, where will it go to get its savor again? If we are backsliders and never had an experience in the Holy Spirit as something to reinforce our will or encourage us, the Christ Master could not leave us in that state. he had to take into consideration every level of the journey. You understand? So here is where grace comes in now. The salt may lose its savor, but if you take the salt and throw it back with other salt, what will happen to the salt? It will be reinforced. So when he's talking to Peter, the legitimate head of the, of his following, that he should encourage, knowing fully well that he's going to go on. Peter is not aware of this because Peter is not in that high state yet. Peter is not even in the Holy Spirit stage. Peter would have to be aware. Energy acting on energy. Peter is in that state. He's not up in the Holy Spirit state yet. So Peter is made a legitimate head to carry on the church. The Master is going on, but he's promising them that he's not going to abandon them, and he's leaving Peter with a certain certitude that he can carry on in good faith and that he will be reinforced. So they're going to be backsliders. Jesus suspected that a long time even before he took off with the journey, that this is human nature. But he's making compensation for all that by grace. So he actually gives them the promise that the Holy Comforter will come and remind them of all these things in his name. And that's the reinforcement that comes in. When the Spirit came to them on the day of Pentecost, all the backsliders were suddenly pushed in. There was no more doubt in their mind. It was a mind of total certitude. Everyone found himself communing in consciousness. If there was any doubt in their mind that the Master had gone now, and the Master had lived with them, and if there was doubt in their mind that he was truly a Master, that he didn't have any true interest in their life, in the inner world, here they have now the tangible evidence of a force pulling them in, binding them together as a body for the first time. They were like wheat pulled together and bound by a strand. They were now something of value. They were held together. It was the first unification of the disciples in the Spirit. You see, they were cut and scattered from their moorings by the Master. The Master came and cut them down and left them like that. And maybe he put one little baby boy to look after. He says, okay, make sure the wind don't blow it away. So the baby boy may not be too smart enough, but he knows he's got to tie them all together. Then comes the big brother and says, this is the way you tie it. Takes the string and tie it all, okay, now hold it together and go. So Peter might be a little baby boy and not too strong, not too experienced in tying the disciples together as a unit. The Holy Spirit is big brother who comes down now and does the job, pulling them all together into one bond, and then now Peter can carry on. He has something to carry on. This is the reinforcement, and it's grace. But this grace, this promise, is made prior to the journey. You see, all the safety factors, all the promises are already laid out for you before you start on the journey. You're starting out on a journey inward, not knowing where you're going, and not knowing what you'll get, not knowing what is already provided for you to have. But here, for the first time, the journey is laid out. You know what company you're going to be involved in.